And now it's time for the Wild Side News with your host, Sydney Wildsmith.
You'd think by now, with all of our amazing technologies and communications, that people could find a way to get along better. But it sure doesn't feel that way. And so we must come up with ever more powerful technologies to protect ourselves from harm. Unfortunately, all too often, the innocent beings are caught in the crossfire. No more telling example exists than the effect that mid-frequency sonar blasts have on marine creatures. Today, we look at the struggle between the U.S. Navy and the laws set up to protect whales and dolphins along America's shores when your Voice of the Earth continues here on the Wild Side News.
Welcome back to the Wild Side News. And now, Sydney Wildsmith.
As Congress prepares to hear the assessment of our progress, or lack thereof, in the struggles in Iraq, and we hear that a terrorist plot against the U.S. had been broken up in Germany this past week, and the portent of perhaps a massive air attack on Iran simmers below the radar, and China continues its massive investments in their military, it seems a good time to do all we can to shore up our defenses. Personally, I believe we should start an immediate assault on wars of any kind and forge peace on Earth. But, as that is probably at least 3 years away, we have to do the best we can with what we have. And that is central to today's show, because the courts this past week stayed an injunction that had prevented the U.S. Navy from conducting training exercises to implement its mid-frequency underwater sonar systems off the coast of Southern California, thereby clearing the way for the training to move full steam ahead. Science has proven that the massive mid-frequency sonar blasts are devastating to marine mammals, whose way of life is built around super-sensitive sensory systems for underwater navigation, location of food and friends, and the very important life-sustaining habits of mating. The truth is that mammals and mid-frequency sonar cannot exist in the same pond. We talk with Michael Jasny, Senior Policy Analyst for the NRDC, which is in the midst of the lawsuit to enforce marine protection regulations on behalf of the resident offshore creatures, which are set to be hammered, damaged, and die from these training exercises. That's coming up in segment 2 of today's show, along with the current nature news. But as always, we begin today's show with the launch of an expanded weekly Earth Summit, which begins right now. Welcome to the Weekly Earth Summit, the most important 15 minutes on Earth. Today, we launch an expanded summit and reach out to an expanding panel of experts who share what's on their mind about nature and the environment. We begin today's meeting as we hear from Carl Pope, president of the Sierra Club, over an issue that is exploding within the environmental movement. Carl?
Late in August, when no one was watching, the Bush administration handed big coal a huge payoff. Mountaintop removal mining, in which the top of a mountain is cut off, dumped into a river or stream to get at the coal underneath, has repeatedly been ruled illegal by the courts. Now the administration wants to make the practice okay, even though it's obviously against the law. But the gift industry may backfire. The administration issued it the rule on Friday, thinking no one would notice, but the New York Times broke the story on Wednesday. The public outcry was immediate, swift, and sudden. People were reading and hearing about what has been happening quietly for years. Back in May, EPA filed a $2 billion enforcement action against Massey Coal for thousands of mountaintop removal violations of the Clean Water Act. Bush's regulation was a hint that this enforcement action might be settled in a sweetheart deal. So what happened? By the following Monday, the Sierra Club, Earth Justice, the Appalachian Center for the Environment, Coal River Mountain Watch, the West Virginia Highlands Conservancy, and the Ohio Valley Environmental Coalition filed as interveners, making sure the government couldn't sell out. Forewarned is forearmed. America is waking up to the war that is being waged by Bush and Big Coal on the people of Appalachia.
Thank you, Carl. The issue of mountaintop removal is approaching a crusade to care for our land. Ben Lowe, one of our upcoming voices for the Earth, speaks up for the people and the land of the Appalachians. Ben?
The Lord is the great God, the great King above all gods, and His hand are the depths of the earth, and the mountain peaks belong to Him. That's Psalm 95, 3-4. The mountain peaks belong to God, according to the psalmist, and yet every day 3 million pounds of explosives will be used to tear down mountains in West Virginia alone. The practice of mining coal through mountaintop removal is an outrage. Mountaintop removal destroys the land and devastates local communities. It's hard to believe that this injustice is actually going on today. It is also sobering to realize that most of the coal extracted from Appalachia goes to generate electricity that we consume in the rest of the nation. At the same time, it is encouraging to know that it does not have to be this way. There are better, cleaner, healthier ways to extract coal, and mining companies should be held accountable for their actions. Personally, we can all reduce our electricity consumption through simple conservation practices. Beyond that, though, we can join together to raise awareness and encourage positive change. Christians around the country are starting to hear about this, and we're organizing to support our neighbors under assault in Appalachia. It is an uphill battle for sure, but we hold on to the hope that we read of in the Bible in Isaiah chapter 54, verse 10. Though the mountains be shaken and the hills be removed, yet my unfailing love for you will not be shaken, nor my covenant of peace be removed, says the Lord who has compassion on you.
Ben works with La Rocha, a faith-based global network for the environment. You can find out more about La Rocha by going to www.larocha.org. There are deep roots to our connection with this earth, and Robert Kennedy Jr. enriches our understanding of their ancient and spiritual depth. Robert?
That in every religious tradition throughout the history of mankind, the central epiphany always occurs in the wilderness. Buddha had to go to the wilderness to experience nirvana and self-realization. Muhammad had to go to the wilderness of Mount Haran 609 to climb the summit in the middle of the night and wrestle an angel there to have the Quran squeezed from him. Moses had to go to the wilderness of Mount Sinai for 40 days to get the commandments. The Jews had to wander the wilderness for 40 years to purge themselves of the 400 years of slavery in Egypt. Christ had to go to the wilderness for 40 days to discover his divinity for the first time. His mentor was John the Baptist, a man who lived in a cave in the Jordan Valley and dressed in the skins of wild beasts and ate locusts and honey. And all of Christ's parables were taken from nature. I am the vine, you are the branches, the mustard seed, the little swallows, the scattering the seeds on the fallow ground. He called himself a fisherman, a farmer, a vineyard keeper, a shepherd. The reason he did that, and it's the same reason all the Talmudic prophets, the Old Testament prophets, the Quranic prophets, all the way back to the pagan prophets like Esau, used fables and allegories and parables drawn from nature to teach us the difference between right and wrong and teach us what the face of God looks like. And the reason they did that was because that's how they stayed in touch with the people. Christ was saying things that were revolutionary. He was revolting against fundamentalism of his time, the fundamentalists of his own time. And the people would have dismissed him as a quack because he was contradicting everything they had heard from the literate, sophisticated people of their time. But he was able to confirm, they were able to confirm the wisdom of his parables through their own observations of the fishes and the birds. And they were able to say, he's not telling us something new. He's simply illuminating something very, very old. Messages that were written into creation by the Creator at the beginning of time. And we haven't been able to discern or decipher them until the prophets came, who had immersed themselves in wilderness, learned the language, and come back to the cities to teach us about the wisdom of God. And, you know, this is where our values come from, our most fundamental values of community and morality. And, you know, when we destroy these, we're not just destroying an economic resource, and we are doing that. The economy is a wholly owned subsidiary of the environment. But we're destroying a broader resource that goes to our humanity. And when we do that, you know, we lose at some point, we'll lose our ability to be humane, and God help us all.
You can hear Robert Kennedy Jr. each week on Ring of Fire, broadcast on the Air America Networks. Thank you, Robert. There are so many issues these days, it's sometimes difficult to know which one is most important. Dr. David Suzuki, one of the finest voices of nature, helps us sort it out. Dr. Suzuki?
This is a question people are always asking me. Which is the most important environmental issue? Is it global warming, toxic pollution, disappearance of fishes in the oceans? Well, I mean, all of these things, we have no idea which is the one that's going to tip us over the edge. The global warming is, you know, the effect on the atmosphere is so immense. The repercussions are huge. I mean, the oceans are changing in large part because of global warming. You know, we have the largest sockeye salmon run in the world in the Fraser River. This year we had what was considered a large run of 15 million fish. But the great fear is that those fish won't make it to their spawning grounds because they're very temperature sensitive. And with global warming, the temperature of the Fraser River is getting higher and higher. So there, all of these things are interlinked. But I think the fundamental challenge is that the heart of the crisis is us, and it is the values that we cling to in our minds, our brains. We think that we are so smart and so important that we are in charge of everything, and that the economy is the thing that must be kept growing at all costs, and to hell with anything else. We are at the heart of the crisis, and yet we forget that we are biological creatures. And the absolute bottom line of the most important need we have is clean air, clean water, clean soil, clean energy, and biodiversity. If we don't have those things, we don't survive. So for God's sake, we've got to protect those things before anything else, and then ask, how do we have an economy and a society that can live in balance with those things? And when you look at it that way, the overriding need that we have is to realize the urgency. I like to say it's the equivalent of 1,000 Pearl Harbors going off at once. And that's the level of challenge.
I encourage everyone to track on Dr. Suzuki's work through the Suzuki Foundation. Thank you, Dr. Suzuki. How do we manage to balance our passions and convictions as to what we must do next? Dr. Matthew Sleeth, author of Serve God, Save the Planet, always seems to find a way. Matthew?
Our family had a husband and wife over for dinner last summer, who labored hard for the Lord. Their ministry touches the lives of thousands. They've done this for decades despite getting very little positive feedback. The husband disagrees with me about some aspects of environmental science. Still, we are friends. We have no argument. After sharing a meal together, he prayed, thanking God for being with us because, not despite, our differences. Could I be wrong about society's CO2 emissions causing global warming? Yes, I've been wrong about many things. When students start medical school, they are told the following. One half of what we will teach you over the next 4 years is wrong. The problem is, we don't know which half. If left with this warning alone, every physician would be lost. Fortunately, we also have another axiom under which to work. First, do no harm. For me and my friend, the most important and overriding consideration is to bring people to the peace that passes all understanding. Jesus says, "Come to me, all of you who are weary and carry heavy burdens, and I will give you rest. Take my yoke upon you, because I'm humble and gentle at heart, and you will find rest for your soul. For my yoke is easy to bear, and my burden I give you is light." This is why and how two brothers and sisters can sit at the table and eat in peace despite scientific or ideologic differences. Our Savior is gentle at heart, and we must learn from him. We must first do no harm. Paul the Apostle teaches this principle of harmony and loyalty to a higher cause. I quote, "I try to find common ground with everyone, doing everything I can to save some. I do everything to spread the good news and share its blessings." End quote. The common ground for our dinner guests and us is the belief in a gospel and a need to share it with those who are weary of life's heavy burdens. I believe that God gives us resources. We are called to be good stewards and to use our time, health, money, oil, education, etc. to love our neighbors as ourselves. My friend and I are on the same page when it comes to this. I may disagree with someone over whether nitrous oxide, carbon dioxide, or methane deflect light at 1,000 angstroms versus 5,000 or a million. However, the most important thing, the thing we must agree on, the world and everything in it is in need of rescue. Believing and spreading that news is what allows us to sit at one dinner table now and forever in fellowship. If we place that belief above all others, we will get more than half right, and we will do no harm.
Thank you, Dr. Sleeth. And thank you for tuning in to this week's Weekly Earth Summit. And join us next week as we invite voices from around the world to share their thoughts during the most important 15 minutes on Earth, the Weekly Earth Summit. This week, the idea of how we learn to share the earth equitably for all of we living creatures keeps demanding an answer. And that's the bottom line in the battle being waged as the courts try to weigh in on what defines national security. We go in depth into the struggles being waged in the shores off the coast of Southern California when your voice of the earth continues here on the Wild Side News.
Catcher's mitt.
I'm getting ice skates.
I'm getting a jigsaw puzzle.
I'm getting dying coral reefs.
A blue bicycle.
A walkie-talkie.
I'm getting a severe drought.
Cool black skateboard.
I'm getting melted ice caps.
A killer heat wave.
A shrinking glacier.
I'm getting a devastating flood.
Adults are generous. We're even giving kids global warming. But it's not too late. We can still reduce greenhouse gas pollution. Go to fightglobalwarming.com. Brought to you by Environmental Defense, the Robertson Foundation, and the Ad Council.
Welcome back to the Wild Side News. And now, Sydney Wildsmith.
Cohabiting this earth is becoming an ever bigger challenge as populations fill in all the open spaces with human endeavors and technology stretches its probing fingers into the most sacred reaches of our world. And a global economy pulls everything into the open marketplace of commodification. There is a challenging war being waged as to who owns the vested interests of we the people. And it's happening off the shores of Southern California. Stay tuned. For years, the U.S. Navy has run much of its training from the array of bases and research facilities located in Southern California. The increasing challenges of national security drive an ever more stringent demand for the right of the space to train and prepare our Army, Navy, and Marines. Generally, many within the environmental community find a willingness to partner in efforts to protect the fragile ecosystems that often find themselves in the middle of these military training exercises. But recently, a new war zone has been defined that pits the U.S. Navy and environmental groups as adversaries in the courts to determine who has precedent to the waters of Southern California. Following today's Nature News, we go in depth as we explore mid-frequency sonar training exercises and their far-reaching effects on the whales, dolphins, and other marine mammals that cannot coexist within the testing range. But first, today's nature news. With only 700 wild mountain gorillas left on Earth, the news is reaching the world that the rangers hired to protect the gorillas in the Democratic Republic of the Congo's Virunga National Park have run for their lives as rebels in the area overran their posts. As a result, conservationists have lost all capacity to monitor the status of these severely endangered beings. Rebels overran the various posts, seizing rifles and communications equipment and forcing park workers and their families to evacuate. Recent senseless attacks, which left 9 gorillas slain, raises the level of threat to what those closest to the situation term enormous peril. This is a very serious situation that deserves the immediate attention by the world community. We simply cannot allow the continued slaughter and extinction of our closest relatives. God may not forgive us if we let this stand. Negotiators from 158 countries reached basic agreement Friday on rough targets aimed at getting some of the world's largest polluters to reduce emissions of their greenhouse gases, which are blamed for global warming. The week-long UN climate conference concluded that industrialized countries strive to cut emissions by 25% to 40% of their 1990 levels by 2020. Experts said that the target would serve as a loose guide for a major international climate summit to be held in December in Bali, Indonesia. The Bali conference will try to forge a new global agreement to cut greenhouse gas emissions after 2012, when the 1997 Kyoto protocols expire. The Kyoto Accord required 35 industrial nations to cut their emissions 5% below the 1990 levels by 2012. Rumors are spreading fast around the world about a new battery technology that would make all other batteries obsolete. An Austin-based startup company called EE Store created the buzz when it promised the technology to replace electrochemical batteries. Such an advance could potentially mean that you plug in your car for 5 minutes and drive for 500 miles. Sound too good to be true? Time will tell. But clean tech is here, and it will revolutionize how we live and how we do business. Clean tech. Pass it on. It's a technology that goes back into Greek and Roman times. It's the hot springs and baths, the waters of which were heated by the earth itself. We see hot water in geothermal pools in Yellowstone and around the world. New Zealand gets quite a bit of its energy from hot rocks. Research into geothermal suggests that we have a clean, quiet, and virtually inexhaustible source of renewable energy that could fulfill the world's energy needs 250,000 times over, with nearly zero impact on the climate or the environment. So why aren't we exploring this more? Some dimwit decided to pull funding for researching this in the year 2000. While there's still enough energy left, please, someone, turn on the light. Pope Benedict made another strong appeal for the protection of the environment, saying issues such as climate change had become gravely important for the entire human race. And we all know who advises him. And I'm sure you've wondered many times why grizzlies seem to enjoy rubbing their backs up against a tree so much. Having spent time in grizzly country, I could assume it's black fly and horse fly bites. Well, scientists haven't figured out a way to actually ask a grizzly why he does that so much, but they have been secretly watching, and they've determined that it's actually a way for grizzlies to mark their territory, much like dogs when they scent mark. Grizzlies live a life going around in huge loops in their environment, and by marking the trees, as they do, it signals to other male grizzlies, and to interested females, that one big bad bear owns this turf. And as male grizzlies get involved in some of the most ferocious fights on the earth, it just may serve as fair warning to a male grizzly that if he wanders much farther into this piece of ground, he'd better be ready for one hell of a fight. They've had their fair warning. And that's the news. And a brief announcement. If you have some news you wish to share, send it to me at wildsidenews@cox.net. That's wildsidenews@cox.net. We'll be glad you did. And now we head on out to the warm waters of Southern California, where a firestorm of wills is heating up. Here it is September, and a lot of people are talking about the future of the war in Iraq. Just recently, this last week, there's been a decision by the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals that relates to the Navy's use of mid-range sonar in Southern California as a test and training for very quiet deep-sea submarines that are creeping around the ocean floors these days. And unfortunately, this particular form of sonar can be very, very dangerous and damaging to marine mammals. However, nevertheless, there's been a decision in this case that dramatically impacts the livelihood and well-being of marine species. And to help us understand the depth of the story and the breadth of it is Michael Jasny, who's talking to us from Vancouver, B.C. He's the senior policy analyst with the NRDC, and we've talked before. Michael, I want to welcome you back to the Wild Side News.
It's a pleasure to be here, Sydney. Thanks for having me on.
Why don't you give us a little bit of history, because the NRDC specifically has been involved in this lawsuit and the way in which you're approaching this particular situation.
Sure. Well, we've at NRDC have been concerned for years about the impacts of Navy high-intensity sonar on marine mammals. This is a technology that is known to cause strandings and serious injury and mortality in whales, and to have a range of other impacts on various marine mammals. For some time, we did everything we could to persuade the Navy to bring itself into compliance, to prepare environmental impact statements, to apply for permits under the Marine Mammal Protection Act, and do all that the law requires them to minimize the impacts from their testing and training with this technology. But for years, they resisted, and it is only now, after litigation has been filed, that the Navy finally began to get its act together. That's where we stand. Unfortunately, the preliminary work that the Navy has done, environmental assessments to deal with some of the major exercises that they've been undertaking, first off of Hawaii and now off of Southern California, are completely inadequate. They're just completely inadequate in terms of the mitigation that they prescribe, not to mention the analysis that they engage in. A court battle that you're alluding to is over what the Navy has done or failed to do in Southern California.
Let's start out with a little background in terms of what you know and can share about what is actually involved in these tests, so that people have an understanding of what's occurring and then how that literally affects particularly the whales and dolphins, but many other mammal species. Let's talk about the science of mid-range sonar and its effects on sea mammals.
Sure. Well, mid-frequency sonar, the kind that the Navy uses, operates at very, very high intensity sound. The source level for mid-frequency sonar system, for some of them anyway, is around 235 decibels. Can even go a bit higher than that, though the maximum source level is classified. So we're talking about levels of sound that could do a lot of damage. When you couple that to the fact that sound travels very far underwater, much further underwater than it does in air, generally speaking, and the fact that marine mammals are effectively acoustic creatures, that they have evolved over millions of years to rely on sound as their primary sense and depend on their ability to hear and to be heard for their very survival. When you put all that together, you really have the potential to do a great deal of damage in using high-intensity sound in the sea. What has emerged over the past decade is that the Navy's mid-frequency sonar system, which, again, are putting out sound at levels of 235 decibels, has been associated with a growing number of mortality events in marine mammals. What you see is mass strandings of animals, which are deep-water animals, which very rarely strand, even singly, coming up in numbers and stranding over long stretches of beach, sometimes with other species as well. And sometimes these animals strand. It may be that they're just being herded effectively onto the shores where they die. But in some cases, and in quite a few cases, animals have been recovered in time to give evidence of very strange pathology. The animals show hemorrhaging, bleeding around the brain in the acoustic fat, which is an organ related to hearing, in and around the ears, they show what appear to be emboli in organ tissue, like the liver and other parts of the body. The best hypothesis that has been advanced in the published literature as to what's going on is that the animals are suffering from a syndrome of symptoms that appear consistent with the kinds of things you see in humans and other animals suffering from acute decompression sickness. So one of the most interesting things that's actually been discovered scientifically coming out of all of this, all these investigations, is that it's like at least some marine mammals are susceptible to something like the bends. That anyway is the leading theory in the literature as to precisely what's going on. But regardless of the actual causal mechanism, it's clear that a mid-frequency sonar is injuring animals severely and is injuring them at sea in addition to causing them to strand. On top of this, there is a range of other impacts, disruptions in foraging, causing some animals to panic and flee an area and other things that collectively over time can have very serious effects on an animal's fitness.
Are you able to give us a concept of what a 235 decibel level might be comparable to in our world?
I think the best thing to do is to compare these source levels to levels that we know produce certain impacts in marine mammals. So in that case, you're comparing, you know, oranges to oranges instead of to apples.
Okay.
You've got, again, you've got these sonars operating at levels of 235 decibels or above. In the few cases where we have sufficient data, it would appear that sonar is causing lethal effects in at least some species of marine mammals under some circumstances. At levels of around 160, 165 decibels, perhaps even lower. It's clear from research that's been done on a range of species, right whales, harbor porpoises, killer whales, mid-frequency sonar and other mid-frequency sources are producing profound impact on marine mammals, again, causing them to panic and flee for tens of miles, disrupting their foraging activity and so on, at received levels of 130 decibels and above, or even for some species, much lower than that. So a single Navy exercise involving a number of ships, each of them using sonar, 235 decibels, or some of them using other acoustic sources, perhaps a bit lower in intensity, all of that creates a sound field that can really transform the acoustic environment for some species, making it really inhospitable over a very significant area of ocean.
Yes.
That's a central problem. Given that the Navy runs exercises repeatedly in certain areas, we're talking not only about potential for very serious acute effects, including lethality, but also potential for long-term cumulative impacts on the entire population.
It's obvious that whales in particular have the capacity to communicate over many, many miles with their echolocation and communications, so therefore they would be extremely impacted by such incredible sounds, and as well they're already being bombarded by just the noise, the ambient noise in the oceans caused by all the various sea traffic and other, cargo ships and things. So they're struggling in many cases to try to find their own way, in particular because it's like having static on our telephone lines to the point where we finally can't hear anything anymore.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. I mean, that's a really good point, Sydney. Sonar is an incredibly important part of this problem. There are other contributors to it, which are making for a very difficult situation for some species. Shipping noise is a good case in point. There are some marine mammals, and I think you may have been alluding to this, like blue whales and fin whales that are believed to have evolved their calls to be able to communicate across entire ocean basins.
Right.
So if you imagine that originally fin whales might be communicating, trying to locate mates or send some other identifying information over a thousand miles, that range of communication has been compressed because of all the shipping noise in the ocean over the last few generations of whales, from 1,000 to 100 to, in some cases, maybe 10 or tens of miles. I mean, that could have a very significant impact on the ability of these animals to breed and to continue to function. One of the things that has been noticed about northern right whales, as opposed to, say, their cousins in the southern hemisphere, southern right whales, is that they're breeding a lot less frequently than whales in the southern hemisphere. No one knows exactly why, but one salient difference in the environments of the two species of whales that's been raised is the difference in ambient noise, that in the southern hemisphere, animals have something closer to a pristine acoustic environment, whereas up in the northern hemisphere, the northern right whale is persisting in a kind of acoustic fog. So this is an environmental problem which extends beyond sonar, which is, I think, affecting some species in ways that perhaps go to their core ability to survive and reproduce.
And I think that's really the important point here, is these animals are already stressed to the point, just trying to figure out how to survive, that it isn't as if this one event is the singular factor. It is the fact that these animals are doing the best they can to figure out how to work around all of these environmental impacts. And that simply has to be taken into account.
Yeah, you're right. And fortunately, it's not the way that we regulate.
Yes.
I mean, there's a lot of lip service paid to the idea of ecosystem management. The idea that you have to manage areas or populations of wildlife holistically and consider all of the stressors that are acting on them. But for various reasons, that's not the way that the things are done. Certainly one thing that we would recommend is that, at least starting in our international marine sanctuaries and in other MPAs, that we begin to try to manage marine mammal species holistically. And as part of that, certainly consider the amount of noise and noise budget that they have to cope with.
Right. Let's focus on this particular lawsuit because it's going through some dynamics right now that are important. The NRDC and others did join together to file lawsuits to put an injunction against the tests that were scheduled for the Navy in the Southern California area, which I believe were scheduled between 2007 and 2009 and involved something like 14 series of tests. Am I anywhere close there?
Yeah, that's pretty much dead on. It's 14 major exercises between now and January 2009 in the Southern California area.
Can you define what's involved in one exercise? Do we have a sense of what that is?
Yeah, well, each of these exercises, I have to say, involve more than just active sonar. They also involve ordnance firing, they involve use of explosives, and just a whole range of other things going on as well, some of which, of course, have their own acoustic impacts or really complicate the sound field that wildlife in the area has to cope with. We challenged, in particular, the mid-frequency sonar components to these training exercises. These mid-frequency sonar exercises, which are part of these broader events, they all involve ships trying to detect underwater targets in the water. So a surface ship trying to detect a submarine, or a helicopter, or fixed-wing aircraft trying to detect a submarine in the area.
We really do have to be fair to the Navy because the Navy is not our enemy. And as a matter of fact, they work for us and on behalf of us, and they're really trying to do the best they can. And I think for the listeners to understand what these are training exercises where they're testing out these newest technologies to locate super silent diesel submarines that certain nations are utilizing these days, which could conceivably pose a threat. And so in terms of, you know, creating a functional Navy that can protect us effectively, that's what these are designed to do. I don't have any problem with that because I do want to be protected against such potential threats. And I think everybody else does as well. The very specific issue here is the location of these in Southern California. The reason that the Navy would say that they're there, and it's true, I'm sure that they're telling us exactly their situation, is they have a huge investment in the various devices and top secret technologies that are utilized, and they can synchronize to conduct these tests in this Southern California area. As well, however, there are other places where they can do this. It's just, to some degree, somewhat inconvenient to do so there because we're so set up here. Is that somewhat correct?
Yeah, it's somewhat correct. I mean, I should say that these are training exercises, and the Navy has some flexibility in its training, just the way that the Army does on land. I mean, when the Marine Corps trains in Camp Pendleton, they take lots of precautions to minimize the impact of their training on endangered and threatened species and another wildlife in the area. Unfortunately, this is, I think, is one area in which marine management is lagging well behind terrestrial management. That tends to be a general theme of ocean conservation. In this case, there's quite a lot that the Navy can do to reduce the impacts of their activities.
As a matter of fact, you were able to have mitigation applied to these exercises, which was being enforced by the courts.
Well, that's right. Last June, the Navy wanted to run one of its largest exercises off of Hawaii, and wanted to run it 2 years after a mass stranding of some 200 melon-headed whales off the coast of Kauai. The National Marine Fisheries Service took a look at this, and though there was obviously little evidence available, nonetheless concluded that based upon what they were able to reconstruct, the Navy sonar use was possible, if not likely, contributing cause to that mass stranding event. After this, the mitigation that the Navy wanted to apply to that exercise was very poor, and the federal district court recognized that it was insufficient as a matter of law, that the law required them to do more to protect wildlife. And so there was a stipulated agreement that the court endorsed, which allowed the Navy to proceed with this exercise while employing significantly greater mitigation. The Navy, since then, has gone back on a substantial part of that mitigation until about the only thing that they're doing is looking out on the surface of the water to see if they can spot whales. And if a marine mammal turns up within an extremely short distance of the ship, either powering down or shutting off their sonar, this is a technique, while being somewhat helpful, has a relatively small impact on the total amount of damage that mid-frequency sonar training can cause. The court in the latest lawsuit found that the mitigation that the Navy wanted to apply was quote, woefully inadequate and ineffectual. So, the Navy has been really recalcitrant, has been unwilling to engage in mitigation that it's done in the past and which other navies are performing as well.
A lot of people hear the word mitigation, and that sounds like a legalistic term. Mitigation actually translates into actual actions they were agreed or constrained to conform to. Why don't you give a sense of what those were, because that is where we start, and then we'll talk about what happened with that, even those decisions.
Sure. Well, the Navy was required to, with the exception of three training events within the larger exercise, was required to keep away from the coast, where you have a greater chance of strandings and also higher density of marine mammals. They were, in the case of Hawaii, required to keep out of the recently designated Marine National Monument in the northwestern Hawaiian Islands. They were required to observe a larger safety zone during certain higher risk conditions. They were required to take special precautions when operating sonar at night, when marine mammals are particularly hard to observe. So there were quite a few mitigation measures that the Navy was required to undertake. They have since given up on all the ones I mentioned and some others besides. Now, one thing I should mention is that the California Coastal Commission, representing the state of California, took a look at this, and they, in trying to come up with a meaningful balance between the Navy's desire to train off of California and the state's natural interest in protecting its resources, came up with a list of safety measures that the Navy should pursue, and these included things like avoiding the gray whale migration and avoiding other areas that are known to have high concentrations of marine mammals and endangered and threatened species. And the Navy has refused to do these things. It has refused the state of California's recommendations and conditions for training. Now, one of the recent court opinions has pointed out is that so much of the conflict, as it's developed, really is a matter of the Navy's refusing to do things that it can do, including things that it's done in the past.
It's a bit of an unusual precedent in the sense that, for example, environmental protection has always been a very powerful constraint on various levels of actions. In this particular case, it's become a standoff between vested interests of the military and their role in national defense, and as well those environmental protections that are afforded on behalf of the public. And whereas before the environmental constraints really did take precedent, this has been changed now, and there's kind of a new priority. Why don't you describe what the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, their decision by the three-judge panel?
Yeah, well, it was a split decision. So you had two judges going one way and one judge going the other way. The Navy, after it was enjoined from using mid-frequency sonar in these major exercises by a district court, it appealed the district court's decision. The appeal is still in process, and it won't be heard for another month or so. But in the meanwhile, they sought a what's known as a stay of the injunction. They asked an emergency panel at the Ninth Circuit to hold off on the application of the injunction while the appeal goes on. And the decision that came back was split 2-1. The majority decided that the public interest favored the Navy's being able to continue to use the system while the appeal was pending. The dissent, among other things, pointed out that the environment matters as well, that the harm that had been on the evidentiary record that the district court had responded to the marine environment was significant, and that the district court had looked carefully at what the possible harm to the Navy and found that the harm to the environment outweighed harm to the Navy, and that therefore the injunction should be kept in place. So all of these issues are going to be decided within the full appeal in a month or two. We certainly hope that the panel will take a very close look at the substantive issues, at repeated violations of law that the Navy has engaged in, at the real equities of this case, and particularly the Navy's repeated refusal to adopt adequate mitigation measures, and the real public interest in environmental protection, and will allow the injunction to proceed.
And just because people can get so inflamed about them, I just want to reiterate the fact that we're not talking about banning national defense on our coast, but actually what this is specifically addressed to is training. Members of the Navy, on the southern coast of California to conduct these exercises. They can do this in other places. So that really is what we're talking about here. I don't want anyone to think under any circumstances that there's some effort to completely ban this use of sonar. There's many different issues here, but this really has to do specifically with the training off the southern coast of California. The dissenting judge actually suggested, if I'm not mistaken, that one of the reasons he dissented was because he felt that in going ahead, your original case would be supported. And how does that look for you?
Yeah, the dissent found it was clear that to a near certainty that plaintiffs would prevail, that the Navy hadn't raised even serious questions about their legal violations. And indeed, there was no real question of this even by the majority, in the majority opinion. The court has to look at whether there was an abuse of discretion, whether the district court made a serious error in finding, first of all, that the Navy had violated the National Environmental Policy Act and the Coastal Zone Management Act, and second, that if the Navy was allowed to go forth with its training in the way that they want, without adequate mitigation, in other words, that marine wildlife would be irreparably harmed. So the court would have to find that, in fact, there was a real possibility that the Navy hadn't violated the law, or that the NRDC and others hadn't shown that the environment would be irreparably harmed. This is a case that I think the Navy's violations of law are clear and they're repeated, and I think the science well establishes the serious harm that results from the use of mid-frequency sonar. So,
if you weren't involved in this particular lawsuit over this issue, but more generally speaking, how to work with the Navy in accomplishing their mission, but as well protecting the marine mammals and other creatures, what do you think might be a trade-off that might be equitable? They're not going to stop. They're just not going to put this thing to bed. They can't. If a person were to work compromise, what would you be suggesting?
Both the environmental and the scientific communities have for years been recommending a number of steps that the Navy can take. The first and possibly foremost is establishing avoidance areas, places where you don't use sonar, putting a bit of a buffer around them. And these would be places where you would expect to find concentrations of vulnerable species, vulnerable either because they're particularly affected by mid-frequency sonar, or vulnerable because of their conservation status. They might be endangered or threatened, or both. So that's to start with. And there are a number of other steps that have been recommended, again, by the scientific community, by the state of California, by the courts, that we think represent an appropriate balance between the Navy's need to train effectively and the need for it to be a real steward of the environment. And these include expanding the existing safety zones that the Navy monitors for, improving its monitoring so that there's a greater chance it'll be able to detect a marine mammal before it gets too close or the ship gets too close to it, taking certain precautions during conditions of heightened environmental risk. And for example, there are steps that some other navies take during surface ducting conditions when noise spreads far along the surface, or during low visibility conditions that you know we think the Navy should consider as well. So there are quite a few things that can be done and should be, we think would allow the Navy to train effectively and at the same time would to the maximum possible extent protect whales and other marine animals.
Mm-hmm. Time will tell on this one, and perhaps we'll have a conversation here down the road here as determinations are made, the legal system steps up and deals with this. How soon do you expect some sort of a decision?
We would probably expect a decision in October or November. I think the dates are still being worked out.
If you did not succeed in your efforts, are you left any other options?
This is a suit on preliminary injunction, and mm-hmm. It would, after an appeal, presumably then go to the merits, to the district court judge. Mm-hmm. But we're obviously looking at this one step at a time.
Mm-hmm. But at this time, sonar can be utilized off the shores of Southern California. Based on your knowledge of whales and mammals, when are critical times when this would be the most damaging to these creatures?
Well, probably when they're engaged in activities that are really vital.
Such as mating and migrating.
Exactly, and foraging as well. Mm-hmm. Some animals, particularly baleen whales, have a really limited foraging period. They have to eat all that they need for the course of the year, and if they want to reproduce for caring and birthing and nursing a calf, all within a relatively brief time period. So to really interrupt that process, make it harder for them to forage, to really risk their ability to get by in the following year and to reproduce, and that really matters since many of those large whale species are endangered.
I have every belief that in the future here, all of us will learn to share these resources more equitably, which is what we have to do. We just simply have to learn to try to figure out a way to share them, because if we don't, we start really getting into these fist fights and other forms, and everybody comes out a loser.
Right.
Michael Jasny with NRDC, Senior Policy Analyst, talking to us from up in Vancouver, B.C. I want to thank you so much for giving us this update. We'll be talking with you in the future to find out what's happened.
Great. Well, my pleasure, Sydney. Anytime.
If you wish to learn more about this issue, you can track its progress on the NRDC website at www.nrdc.org. And a final thought. I work every day to help keep this planet alive and to restore some semblance of balance and sustainability. And the more I've looked at this, the more I realize that the most important environmental issue on planet Earth is war. Save the Earth. Live for peace. It's something every single one of us must do every day. This is Sidney Wildsmith saying adios until we meet again next Thursday or any time on the archives when your voice of the earth rings out around the world here on the Wild Side News.